Hello and welcome, everybody. The Festival du Premier Roman has two English committees. They are composed of both French speakers and native English speakers. This year, the reader's selection is Crow Court by Andy Charman. We are delighted to have Andy with us here at the festival, who is joining us from Surrey in England, and we thank him for his presence. So now, without further ado, I give the floor to Andy.
Thank you very much for welcoming me and for selecting Crow Court and for giving me such a warm welcome. It's been a real pleasure to be at the festival. Shall I read a little first?
Yes. Or would you like to introduce yourself too and give a little introduction then?
There's not a lot to say really because it's my first novel, so hopefully in future I'll have a long list of accolades to impress you with, but for the moment I just have Crow Court to my name, which was, as you know, of course, long listed for the Desmond Elliott Prize, and I found out last week it is also on a short list for the Crime Writers Association Dagger Awards for Historical Novel of 2022, which is exciting.
It's great.
Yes, the only other thing maybe you should know about me is that I was trying to be a writer for very, very many years. I started when I was very young. I started when I was 13, was when I first wrote the first chapter of a first novel. And it took me, 42 years to get into print. So for me, as a consequence of that really long period of effort, and I was trying all the time, I was writing in my spare time for 40 years. So to be at an event like this, this is really the first time I've been to a large, full-on, proper literary festival, partly because of lockdown, but also because it's the first one I've been invited to. It's the culmination of a lot of work and many, many years' effort. So I'm probably, of all the authors here, I think I'm among the most pleased to be here.
And we're very pleased to have you with us. So that'd be great to have a reading of Crow Court from selection from you.
Sure. Well, I like reading Crow Court. It's that's a surprise to me, right? When you pick your own book up and you start looking at your own writing, usually you spot little errors in it and faults and flaws. And sometimes your toes curl on their own and then your hands curl and you just want to throw it away. But actually, I went on a course many years ago and I was struggling to be published, as I said. And a woman called Stella Duffy, I don't know if you've heard of her, she's published many books. She just said, you're finishing too soon. You need another draft and you need to keep going until it's just a little better than you keep sending it to publishers too soon. So I took her advice and carried on working on this until I could find no more flaws in it. Which sort of means that as I was revising it, I was changing the text from its original two or three or four times. Some of these stories I completely scrapped and started again from scratch maybe two or three times. So when I come back to it, I never really remember which story I'm going to be reading. It's always a little bit of a surprise to me. And it's obviously it's a real delight when I discover that I quite like my own writing. At times, that's daunting now because I'm trying to write another novel and I come back to this and I go, I'm not sure I can write like that again. Guess I can. So I'd like to read you three little sections. We are generally heading towards the end part of the festival. We have 2 days left. One day left. Well, 1 day after today, yeah. So I thought I'd read. I hope there's nobody here who's waiting to get to the end of the novel who hasn't finished it yet. I'm not going to ruin, because I'm going to ruin it for you, if that's the case. I thought I'd just read some of the end sections. Because Crow Court tells many stories, there are many endings. So I thought I'd give you one and a half, or two and a half of the endings. One of them concerns a character called Art Pugh, who is, he's a close to my heart, let's say. He appears in very, very small sections through the novel. He's obviously very poor and struggling. And in the story called Art's Last Laugh, we start, this is the one challenge I gave myself in this novel, to write the whole thing in pure Dorset dialect. And Dorset dialect has not only its own terms, it has its own grammar and rules. So fortunately, there are very few experts in Dorset dialect who can tell me where I got it wrong, because I'm sure I did. But so I won't read very much of that, because I think it's the most difficult to understand. But I'll give you a little flavor of the ending of it. Two friends go to see Art. They're going to take him to do a little bit of work on a field where they need to mend some fences. And they recognize that Art is unwell. He hasn't eaten for days. And the narrator says, we're going to have a wager. We'll have a bet. See who can make Art laugh. So they go off into the fields, and they cross a field which is full of cow pats, cow dung, and they start working on the fences. And the one of them is making jokes constantly, trying to get Art to laugh, and Art will not laugh. So I'm just going to read the last page and a half of this. See if you can follow this. This is a challenge. So George remembers the time old Ely got stuck up a tree. He thinks it good enough for a laugh, but Art counts Ely a fool for getting himself up there. Only had one leg, should have stayed on it. George don't give up, though. He brings back so many old stories. Some folks I'd forgotten about all the daft things they done. But Art, he don't think much any of them. So he gets to the Lees, and all the way across, we's a-dancing around, avoiding the cow pats to get to the other side, where we starts work on the fence. Then me and Art's laying out the lugs, and George starts up with telling gags, one after the other. The wife who never farts in her husband's lap, all that sort of stuff. Molly and Jim, this and that, gag after gag. Not a single one of them raises so much as a smile from Art. He just looks at George like he's D-Dar. Hours this goes on. We even fixed up about 10 lugs of fence, and we're all packing up, still dancing around the cow pats. We's a piling broken lugs back in the cart, and George says how he could have been in the army on account of how strong he was. But Art rolls his eyes, like George was making his brags. So I waves George back a step, asking if he could lift it over his head, and he takes two steps back and raises the lug. Can he do another? He steps back again, and sure enough, trips and falls backwards, and he ends up with his arse in a cow pat. George gets up, a swearing and a cursing, and for a moment I veered it's all gone riggy. And then the stench reaches us. Oh, oh, Maya says, you don't half pong. And that's when Art starts to laugh. Georgie's ruddy in the face, he's that angry. That weren't funny, he says. But Art disagrees. Oh, it were. Oh, it really were. And George is chucking the lugs in the barrow, covered with muck and a tanner down, and Art's laugh's getting louder and louder. And the more he laughs, the more George looks ruddy, and the more Art laughs. Carries on all the way home, it does. George cheers up a moment, and Art chuckles. And George comes over all mad again. Quite the day, it were. Sad, though. Weren't more than a week after that, Art took to his sick bed. We buried him on a Monday, in the rain. Sad as they come that day, there were only one thing I were glad of. I was stood there watching the rain pattering on his canvas, and I am to recall that look on his face, the light in his eye, when George landed in the muck. It were art's last laugh. I were glad of it. Not easy. So I'll just read one other little bit, just to indulge myself, if you wouldn't mind. And we'll get right to the end. So this is a story called The Woodpecker and the Mistletoe. And the priest, who we saw early in the story, being a very frustrated and quite an angry man, has met his nephew. The priest is struggling in life because he's lost his faith. And his nephew is a scientist. So he meets him in Lyme Regis, which is very famous in the UK for its fossils. And Giles, the priest, wants his nephew to show him a fossil, because all his life as a priest, he's wanted a sign from God, and he's never got one. And so he's now considering that maybe evolution is the truth, so he wants a sign from science. And his nephew duly produces a fossil from the cliffs. So Giles realizes that for him, that's the decision. There is no God. And he argues this with his nephew. And after the argument, they're about to part. We also learn that Giles feels very guilty because he has been consoling the wife of Charles, who was trying to save his friend from the gallows, from being hanged. And the magistrates ended up hanging both of them. And yeah, Giles could have saved them, but didn't. So they're just about to part, Giles and his nephew, Felix. "I hope it is a smooth trip," Felix said. "Oh, I shan't mind in any case. I rather like the rocking of the waves." "Thank you for your time. You've been very helpful." "It's been my pleasure, Uncle. But you must tell me the conclusion of the mystery, the murdered choirmaster. You say the sailor was wrongly accused and the other man who was hanged was innocent, but..." Giles made ready to explain that no one knew the answer to the mystery. The murderer remained unknown. It was a well-rehearsed response, ready at a moment's notice. "How did you know they were both innocent?" Felix asked. No answer. He had no answer, and his cheeks began burning before he could think of one. He could feel it. They were glowing in seconds. How had he been so careless? "How? Why, they told me. Ellis, I knew because he was planning to... You understand, he went to the authorities to save John Street, knowing that he would be hanged, but he was innocent. He told me so." Felix did not believe him. It was in his eyes. "I see," he said, covering for his understanding. And he repeated, "I see." But his eyes whispered, "Liar." They shook hands after that, smiling awkwardly. They commended each other to their families and said goodbye. Giles kept his eye on Felix from the ship's gunwales as the cob receded into the distance, traced by the wandering trail of smoke from the engine. It didn't matter now. The seabirds whirled and swooped over the waves. Would he ever tell? On his deathbed, perhaps, if there was someone there to hear him? And how would he explain himself? That he did it to save the children? Or as an unanswered challenge to the Almighty? Could he ever explain that anger? It was not something he liked to dwell upon. It was too easy to recall the sensation of the knife scraping on the bone of the choirmaster's ribs, the expression of shock and pain on the man's face, and his thoughts so often echoed with his own words, "What does God owe you now?" He'd spoken it as if to himself, and then the choirmaster had staggered out of the library into the arms of that most unexpected party of visitors, Ellis, Street, and the others. The salt air was sharp in his nostrils, and he suddenly remembered the passage of Darwin. He had to sit. His back was too stiff these days to reach into his bag while standing, and the wind tugged at the pages, making it hard to search, but he found it. As many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and as, consequently, there is a frequently occurring struggle for existence, it follows that any being, if it vary however slightly, in any manner profitable to itself, under the complex and sometimes varying conditions of life, will have a better chance of surviving, and thus be naturally selected. From the strong principle of inheritance, any selected variety will tend to propagate its new and modified form. Giles closed the book, replaced it in his bag, and leaned back in his seat to accept the sun's rays and the damp sea air. There was really no lesson in those words except the meaning they were given. No signs, nothing to speak to him. The only candidate was the notion that a well-executed perfidy would triumph over naive noble-mindedness. But Ellis left children, and he, Giles, did not. He looked up at the broad white cliffs of St. Anselm's Point, all chalk, millions of years worth of accumulated fossils, perhaps the fate of us all. In the end, nothing had any meaning at all. And yet, a black flicker caught his eye. At the back of the boat, there was a crow, perched most incongruously on the stern railing. It stood still, feathers flapping untidily in the breeze, and it looked at him, first with its left eye, and then with its right. Apologies if that was a little long.
Should we take questions from the audience? Would someone like to start with a question for Andy?
Okay, so my question is, as we know, it's a kind of a series of short stories in a sense, but centered around the murder. But the crows are such an integral part, and I want to know at what point did you start off with this idea of the crows and the crow court, and did you send everything around that, or did that just happen as you were writing? Did you decide to throw it in?
So I actually wrote, is that on? Yes. I wrote a children's story that was rejected about a crow called Vicky the Crow. And the title of my children's story was Part Wolf, because Vicky thought she was a weir crow. And yeah, it didn't really work. It was sort of fun writing, but I did a lot of reading about, she thought she was part wolf. She wanted to learn how to howl. And I was reading a lot about crows as a consequence. And it was really a bit of an accident, but crows are extraordinary animals. They're very, very intelligent. So I'll give you two short examples. There is now a unit in the Cambridge University where they study the behavior of crows. And they have behavioral experiments. One day they were conducting a series of experiments to get a crow to pick its food out of a tube with a hook. And they were going to make the access to the food more and more difficult. And as they were building up this experiment, they gave a crow a hook, but they'd forgotten to bend the wire into a hook. So all they gave the crow was a straight piece of wire. And the crow looked at it, picked it up in its beak, put it between the bars of its cage, and bent it into a hook. And the experimenters were astonished and had to rewrite their entire program, because now they'd discovered this was not just a tool-using creature, it was a tool-making creature. Whole different category. Yeah, so, I mean, I was fascinated in their research, and I still follow their research. The other example that I love came from Japan, and the crows in Japan liked one particular nut with a very hard shell, and they dropped the nut in the road so that cars would pass over it and crack the shell, which is kind of clever. But these crows were cleverer than that, because they dropped the nut on a pedestrian crossing. And so they would wait until someone came and pressed the button. And there's a film, you can find it on YouTube, of a crow standing there waiting until the lights change, and then they go out and get the nut and bring it back again. They're really smart animals. So for me, there is this story, farmers will tell you that sometimes they find crows, they'll find individual crows who have been pecked to death, and sometimes they see the gathering. It's actually rooks, not crows, but no. That's a small difference, which in French I'm sure is a difference. They gather in a big circle and they execute one of their own number. And of course it's a mystery why they do this. For me it was a really interesting question to wonder, you know, we think our justice system is very rational and very objective. But if we saw crows with a justice system, would we think of our justice in a different way? Is it actually more intuitive? Is it more of an emotive response? Which is why, so then you have within Crow Court the two justices, right? You have the four guys who go to see the choir master, and their justice will be just to send him out of the town. Then the priest's justice is different again, and then the magistrate's justice is different again. So it built up, all of this built up slowly over time, as I wrote it and I realized there were reflections in different stories. Some of them surprised me. They were accidents. Yeah.
In one of the other get-togethers, you spoke about the connections between the story and your life or your family or where you grew up, and how sometimes it wasn't on purpose, and that you realized after you wrote the book that there were all these elements that actually mirrored or reflected things about your family or the area you grew up. So could you please give us some of those anecdotes?
Yeah, so the one that always comes to mind to think of that is in actually the first story, Concerns for Henry Cuff. And Charles goes to see Henry Cuff's father in a house called Mill House. And Mill House is a real house. It exists next to two mills by the river. And it's where my grandmother lived. And it's those choices, you don't sort of really recognize how your unconscious processing is. I could see him there when I first started writing the character. And because I saw him there, it just slowly became the case that that's where he was. It was a very old house, and it had a very long corridor. So the front door opened into a corridor with dark wood floor and a stairs to the side, and the corridor went through to the kitchen and out to the back. So the light would shine on the corridor. It never had, when I was there, it did not have electric lighting in there, and there was an old grandfather clock. So it was very quiet and very calm, with this very natural light and the ticking of the clock. And yeah, so And that's where Charles comes in, and then he goes around the corner and into a room and doesn't recognize that old Mr. Cuff is sitting like a tree root in his chair, being grumpy. That sort of emerged. The more striking one was about my father, who was, in the translation session this morning, we were looking at a section where it mentions St. Margaret's Hill and St. Margaret's Graveyard. In the middle of that translation section, which is about, being buried in the graveyard, old man Wilkinson says, your forefathers are there, and their forefathers. Well, of me, that's true, right? My grandmother's buried in that graveyard, my grandfather and my other grandmother and their mother. So my great-grandmother is also in that graveyard. And it's sort of like you don't write those things consciously necessary. They're not out of consciousness, but it's not a. It's you realize that these ideas are emerging. My father, that's the slightly more disturbing story. I sort of knew this, but I had not really thought about it until my father read this book. And he doesn't really read novels. He's not interested in literature. He likes funny novels. So he reads Terry Pratchett, and that's about it. And he read this novel, and he was perfectly happy with it and quite pleased and complimentary. And I said, was it okay to read? And he said there was one section that really gave me a shiver down the spine. He said, you know, I was a choir boy in the Minster. I was like, I hadn't thought of that. I did know that, but it hadn't really. I mean, that was the 50s, and it was the 1950s, not the 1850s. So, but he said, but in the vestry, where we had the choir boys' vestments, their gowns, I was the tallest choir boy. He's 6'4", right? 190, 2 meters tall. So his was, and the gowns were in order of height because the roof sloped. So his was at the end. And he said, where you have them going up the stairs to find the murdered choir master, they start next to where my gown was. That's the door. I used to sit and look at that door all the time. So he said that gave him a slight shiver. So I think there's sort of, there are like, how deep do those sorts of memories stay, and what sort of reflections come through when you're writing? I don't know. I won't mention the village because he's probably still alive. So the priest was based on a friend of my mother's, and I went to visit my mother in a little Dorset village, and there was this very sweet, very friendly, very, very polite man was there when I arrived, and we finished having tea and he left, and I asked who it was, and he was a priest from a couple of villages away I don't know why he had become friendly with my mother, because she didn't attend church at all, but he took to her as a friend to cry on her shoulder. Because he was approaching retirement, and he was maybe 5 years away from retiring, and he'd lost his faith. And he was really in an emotional turmoil, because he had to carry on behaving as a priest for his parishioners when he didn't believe in what he was doing anymore. And if he was true to himself, he would quit the priesthood and then have no income. And I thought that was, you know, that's a really, that is a really tough debate. What do you do in those circumstances? Obviously, I don't resolve that. I make him an even worse person. But so yeah, he was based on a real person. And then when I was researching about the impact of Darwin, that was not uncommon. The people who, priests particularly, who had accepted the whole story of literal creation within the Bible, as written in the Bible, then came across Darwin's theories, and it undermined everything that they believed. And there were, yeah, that was a crisis for many people.
Mm. Is that why you set your novel in the Victorian times? Was it to talk about the impact of the discovery of Darwin? Or was there another reason for setting the novel in the Victorian times?
There was another reason. It was a pub. It was just a pub. About 7 miles outside the centre of Wimborne, there is a pub called The World's End. And I used to drive past it when I was a teenager. I used to drive past that pub every day on the way to work. And I had in my mind the idea that there was an age when, if you lived in the town, that was the end of the world, right? It was as far as you could walk, because most people couldn't afford to have a cart or a horse. That was for people with money. So there was a whole world that stayed in one town. And I was then interested, when did that change, and what was it like when that changed? And what was it like to live in such a small world? So I just, originally I wrote one short story, which is called The World's End. And yeah, originally that was going to be a happy story about rustic yokels joking, using dialect. And I thought, I'll find one or two words of dialect that I can just drop into their joking adventures, and they'll be fooling around and it'll be funny. I was going to write a funny short story. And then I started, just all I needed to do was the research to find out, when did railways arrive in Wimborne? Because that would be the end of the insular world. But in discovering that, so the year was 1840, and I also realized, of course, that in the years preceding that, life in the countryside was incredibly difficult. And the more I read about it, the more I realized I could not write a comedy. It was, there was just nothing funny about it. People were starving, and I don't think you have much of a sense of humor when you're starving. So I wrote The World's End as the first story instead. And then the Art's Last Laugh was one of the last stories I wrote. And I carried on doing research and realizing it was more than just one or two words of dialect. That would not be enough. And Art's Last Laugh is like a riposte to that original ambition to write comedy. And by that stage, I was doing so much research that I also had to find out, you know, what were the jokes of Victorian times? What did people find funny? And there were two levels to that as well, because there was, you know, after about 1860, there was Punch magazine, there were humorous magazines, and you can still find copies of those, and they have jokes in them. And most of the jokes are about young women rejecting marriage proposals from young men, in various very harsh and humorous ways. That was the big jokes of the 19th century. But of course, those were all very middle class and very urban jokes. And what I wanted was, what do farmhands joke about? And I can't remember where I eventually found a source, but of course it was very earthy, very crude humour. It was all about cowpats and farts and other unmentionables. So that was how Art's Last Laugh came together.
Yes, you said that you started World's End was your first story. Had you, if I remember correctly, that's when Bill and his brother meet again after 15 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. Had you at that stage already planned that there would be a murder, that they would have to rush away, that they would come back and sort of, you know, get together again, but it was difficult to start with. Had you already planned your book and the whole structure of it, actually?
Oh, I do. I know the answer. It's okay. I'm just going to try and find a little quote. When I started to write it, no, I was just writing short stories. So there's a story behind that as well. I had, as I said earlier, I was working for many years to try and become a published author. And I wrote a crime novel which got rejected. And the rejection was slow and really painful. And I received a phone call saying that they were very excited about this crime novel. And then it took 2 weeks until they responded and said, no, they weren't interested in my crime novel. And then I finally, yes, and then it took me another 6 months until I realized nobody was interested in my crime novel. And so I stopped trying to write for anybody else. And I started writing short stories just for my own interest. I won't spend too long trying to find the section in The World's End. There's one quote there where Bill is angry with Cornelius for having left. Yeah. And Cornelius says, "We had to go. I was accused of murder." He says the major was accused of murder, right? And that's how I wrote it originally. So I had no idea that it would be Cornelius and Bill and Charles and John Street who would be accused of murder. So when I came back to revise, to make the whole thing smooth together so the whole story worked, I looked at that and he said, my master was accused of murder and I had to leave with him. And I thought I would leave it because it's one of those sort of distortions that if he'd had to tell that story many, many times, if you remember, Major Guthrie is really full of himself. So there's no way he would have left the country because his groom committed murder. He would only leave the country because he was accused of murder. So he would have repeated that story many times. It was all about himself. So Cornelius repeats that back. So I left it as it was. But yeah, it's one of those sort of the ways in which working things from different directions creates reflections or accidents.
And just quickly going back to what you said about the short stories, series of short stories, are there any stories that eventually didn't make it into into the book that you had to remove? Either you decided to remove them or your editor said, nah, this doesn't fit in?
I tell you a happy story. In my fantasies as a teenager, when I was going to become a famous, wealthy author, I would send my script off to an editor, and they would be astonished at my genius. And they would say, "Why, Mr. Charman, there's nothing we can change in your manuscript." And her name is Rachel Kerr, who is the editor at Unbound, who first took my book. And bless her, she sent me an email saying, "Well, I've opened a page up for structural changes, Andy, and there's nothing on it." So no, they didn't reject any stories. She did make my dream come true, but there are, I was surprised actually, because I thought that would be an interesting question. So I looked on my computer a couple of weeks ago to check how many stories I'd left out, and I think there were four. I remembered only one. One's really rubbish. Definitely not going to tell you about that one. One of them sort of morphed into Peacock Shawl. But the other one was interesting. The first story tells the marriage of Louisa and Samuel, right? And then they disappear. They're not in the rest of the story. Well, I have another story about what happens to them after their wedding is ruined by the death of poor Henry Cuff. And oh yeah, that was a little section. I'll come back to that. Yeah. So I had the story of there is Charles's wife who has an affair with the farmhand who is serving them at dinner when she meets Charles, and she was Louisa's aunt, I think, something like that. And Louisa discovered on her wedding night that Samuel didn't know much about what he was supposed to be doing. So they have the tragedy of the wedding, and so what would have been their honeymoon was postponed, and then she finally manages to get a new honeymoon, and Samuel hasn't a clue. So the whole thing was the conversation about with what I was trying to do was center it around Louisa's conversations with Anne about how to cope with this situation. And it was too hard. That was too difficult. I mean, that would be a really interesting story to do, but it would take a lot of investigation, and I would need to ask a lot of people, ask questions that might be quite difficult to ask. And it didn't work, so that didn't make it in. But yes, and then the other... there must be half that book again of sections that got left out. Sydney's marriage to Mrs. Wilkinson, Lily. I had the whole marriage process in there and the whole ceremony, because she lifts his self-esteem by saying to him, "You're a marvel, Sid." And he almost left her at the altar, too timid to get married. And she encouraged him by saying, "You're a marvel, Sid." But I had another wedding, and one of the rules is don't repeat scenes. And it's like, okay, but I don't need another wedding. So just the one.
How many stories had you written before you realized you were actually writing a novel? And then what was the process like trying to smooth all of those details, like you mentioned before, to, or how many things did you have to change after to make it coherent?
Good question. I think I got to about six stories before I started to think. So those six stories were still connected. They were the same town, the same people. and yeah, but they were still just a collection. And I think around about that point, I decided to try and expand it and keep telling the story. And then the second part of the question is a really curious answer. One second. I have a coach. My wife actually is a professional coach. She runs a coaching business. Do you understand the idea of coaching? That's quite a cultural notion. So she's not teaching people, she's just enabling them to do what they do well. She is very, very skilled at it, and she no longer coaches individuals. She coaches teams, which is, and group dynamics coaching is like really advanced stuff. So I have a coach, and I've been talking to my coach twice a week for about 8 years. So she's been with me through the whole depressing period of the crime novel failing and through the highs. She is thrilled that I'm here. She's in Ohio in the States. And every phone call we have starts with the same question. She always asks me, "So Andy, what are you writing about?" And it's a different question, it's a different answer every single time. And for me, it's really fascinating that it changes. You know, I'm writing the same story, but actually what the story is about today isn't what it was about last week or 2 weeks ago. So that process of taking first 6 stories and then 8, 10, 12, 14 stories and merging them into one story was almost like a constant response to this question: what are you writing about? What's it really about? Yeah, but what's it really about? And so certainly towards the end, I was looking through at the layers to say what different answers existed to that question. And that was the most satisfying stage of the writing. And it really, it surprises me. So now when I'm coaching other authors, which I do, there are two lessons that are really close to my heart. The one is the lesson that Stella Duffy told me, which is wait, don't judge it yet. Keep working, believe in yourself and keep going. And the other one came from my own experience, which that process of taking 12 stories that were pretty much connected and then really sewing them together, it just took it a different level. I mean, if you read this book 6 months before this draft, it's nowhere near the same. And a lot of that was, well, a lot of that's reading through and just picking out words, reducing it. It's like boiling a sauce down to the essence. But also it was just taking little reflections. I don't know if you noticed, one of my favorite little reflections is that when Cornelius leaves before he goes off to India, he goes with a horse called Penny. Yeah? Yeah. So when she comes back and meets his brother, Penny's now an old horse, but she's still with Bill. It's the same horse. And there is a little reflection, it actually says. And so, of course, that wasn't in the first time I wrote The World's End, because I didn't know Penny was going to be important earlier in the story. So that's something to come back, and Cornelius recognizes Penny. Actually, it's the other way around. Penny recognizes Cornelius. So that was really fun, just going through and picking just little echoes and putting little reflections in the story. And those, I think, I mean, the research makes a lot of difference, but for me, those aspects lift it. So that you can, I mean, I've read this book as a reader 3 times and I still find things that surprise me. Maybe I have a bad memory.
The one chapter that seems quite unlike all the others is the chapter with dear little wannabe Admiral Nelson. It was fun, but it's quite unlike the others. What made you decide to put that in?
Some of that was pure playfulness. As I said at this point, when I was writing that story, I was writing for myself. And I wanted just to see. I've said this phrase many times now. I wanted to see what I could get away with. And I wanted to see if I could get away with writing a story in the present tense, past tense, and future tense. And actually, even with the first draft, it came together really well. I was really surprised. So I rewrote it several times, and it got better, which was good. But then there is the question about, well, why is this story in the book at all? Because it seems like it's nothing to do with anything, right? But John's mother, Selina, is the half-sister of Matthew and sister of Charles. And John reacts to his sisters with a lot of anger, but not enough. They don't really do enough to justify him trying to shoot them or throw himself over a weir. There's a violence in him that seems unjustified. And for me, that was, if it's like something of a cliched metaphor to say, you know, it's ripples in a pond. If it is, but if we're going to use that metaphor, this is the most distant ripple, where you see in John the effects of having an uncle who he never met. But it's like that sort of family memory. I feel it sort of works. He's still echoing the trauma of the family and the impact of the family. And I think that also shows that Selina is a very anxious mother. And so she, of course, will not allow Eliza, the eldest sister, to go to Bible classes, because that's where all of the undescribed, out-of-picture crimes occurred. So Eliza is angry, and John is angry. There's still that residual trauma and anger in the family, not at the surface, but running through the river, through the middle of the town.
I'm not too sure how I'm going to put that across, actually. Morality has a great importance in that book, I think. You mentioned that you talked a lot about justice, two different justice sections. And with morality, there are also two trends. The one which we approve in Charles' behavior to save his mate John. Didn't work out, admittedly, because they both got hung, but anyway. And so, but that's very, very moral. Mm-hmm. And in the end, the person who should have been a proof of morality is, in fact, a murderer. So, I don't know what I want to say about that, but is it...
There's a phrase in English, what's going on there?
Is it important to you? Were you aware that you were opposing the two, in a way?
Opposing the truth, did you say?
The two.
Opposing the two. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yes. Mm. Yes, absolutely. And I'll carry on writing about that, because I think it remains endlessly fascinating. I don't think... Well, I mean, in legal structures... legal experts will tell you the law is not morality. And I think that's, philosophers say the same thing. It isn't. I noticed a couple of months ago, it occurred to me, And I don't know what prompted that thought. But sometimes you'll see children maybe around the age of about 5 or 6, if they notice something going on in the adult world or resulting from adult decisions which are unjust and unfair, children often go into a state of confusion about it. And I'd love to know how young that sense is developed. And do children develop that sense without being taught it? I suspect there is that, you know, there is an innate sense of things not being right. And that's why it comes as confusion. So if children have a feeling for what's right, and crows can make decisions about justice, how much of it is just felt? We feel things rather than encoding them. So for me then, the idea that someone who formally has a role to uphold notions of morality can easily get it wrong, because it's almost like they're going outside themselves. They're relying on a system for actually something that you need to have a feeling for. So at the end, he thinks it's none of it matters. But there's a crow still looking at him. You think so? I'll be writing more about that.
Alison, si tu peux traduire, s'il te plaît. Le thème de la sexualité est également très présent dans le livre, et j'aurais voulu savoir si c'était quelque chose que vous vouliez faire dès le début, l'idée que vous aviez dès le début, ou est-ce que c'est au fur et à mesure de vos recherches que vous avez compris le poids de tous ces interdits sexuels dans la société victorienne, et je suppose particulièrement à la campagne, que vous avez mis en lumière ces différents aspects de la pédophilie, du viol, etc.
Right. So she said that sexuality is an important theme in the book, and she wanted to know if it was something that you intended to talk about from the beginning, or it was something that arose through your research. And talking about the taboos in Victorian society and how that was dealt with, and how did that develop that interest in that theme? Was it at the very start or through your research?
Thank you. You're the first to have asked me about that theme. I've been waiting. Yeah. So for me, there is a discomfort to have the crime committed against the children alongside stories involving same-sex relationships, because those are different worlds. But I couldn't create more separation already than is there, so I left that. And I hope that is not seen as any connection, any parallel, or any. So to answer the first part of your question, it came from research. So I was interested in any book about the period, and I came across a book called Strangers by Graham Robb, which was a wonderful, wonderful history of mostly male same-sex relationships in the 19th century in England. And it was really surprising. For me, the most impactful part of reading about that history was the idea of a death sentence. It was rare. People were not often hanged for falling in love with someone, but it did happen. And in fact, the owner, the grand family, not her, but her nephew, his name was Banks, the very famous family from the area. He liked to live dangerously, so he got caught in the bushes in Green Park in the middle of London with a guardsman by a police officer. Yeah, and the police only existed in London at the time. So there was a big scandal, and he was, you know, the finger was wagged at him, and he was told not to do that again, and that was terrible. And because he was an MP and a very important person, nothing else happened until 2 years later. He was caught with a guardsman in a bush in Green Park, and he then had to leave the country. So, and he had to leave the country really quickly. He went to live in Venice. So for me, a lot of writing, a lot of the enjoyment of writing this novel was exploring as much as I could what was the experience like of living in these times. So that's one of the questions that arose for me. What's it like to live and to feel that to fall in love with someone could be mortally criminal? That's just such a strange and repugnant idea.
The Banks' story is a real story.
Yeah, that really happened. There was, I think, 1828 was around about the last time that someone was hanged for. It wasn't called homosexuality then. I don't know what the crime was, but it probably was. Yeah. So, for me, that was an interesting exploration to try and write about Cornelius and Major Guthrie, and then also about the composer and her partner. And that was particularly satisfying in response to a lot of male authors who love to write about lesbian relationships so that they can get a good sex scene in there. And I was like, okay, I am not even going to make it obvious. I think it's clear, but it's not obvious. For me, that's much more a realistic representation. If you'd known that couple, if you met them and went for tea, then you'd come out going, well, are they or are they not? It would not have been obvious. So it was satisfying to explore, to investigate, you know, to think what it's like to live like that, and then to write. So the other relationship is the three-way relationship in the theatre group, where you have, I forget his name, Thomas, Jasper, and the actress, Cecily, yes. Thank you. It's terrible, I can't remember the names of my own characters. And that was based on, not really a friend, someone I knew at university, this really strange relationship where a character like the prompt was in love with this other guy, Tom, who was just amazingly cruel to him. I mean, they followed each other around all the time, and he would say the most harsh things. And he took it. He was just happy to be with him. It was odd to see. When I started writing those characters, I realized, sort of without deciding to, that I was writing about this couple that I knew. So that became, it's like interesting to get in, stand in other people's shoes and write from their perspective. Yeah. because it's not, we have to finish. Okay, they need to set up. Okay. No, it's not in records, right? So it's not written down, as we know, right? I mean, there of course there are. Not in research that I could find. I'm sure that those problems existed, because those problems exist in our societies. So.
We'll wrap up if there aren't any other questions. And again, to thank Andy for joining us. It's been such a pleasure. We really enjoyed talking to you about the book. And we wish you a lot of luck with your future projects. Maybe you'd like to tell us about your next book.
Yeah, the hardest thing in writing is the synopsis. You spend 2 years writing 60,000 words, and then someone asks you to give it in 100 words, but I'll try. So my next novel is set in the same town, but we're going to move forwards 120 years or so to 1987. And so it's based on a part of my own life. It's not at all autobiographical, except the friends from school are my friends from school. And I came from quite a conventional, quite right-wing family. Standard middle class family. My grandparents were farmers, and I met this guy who came from a very unconventional, very left wing family. They were Quakers and radicals and anarchists, and he moved to my school from a Quaker school, and we met in a school debate in which he was leading the argument for nuclear disarmament, and I, to my shame, was leading the argument against nuclear disarmament. And this was in 1983, around about the same time that really we should have been disarming, because we came close to nuclear war. And anyway, he and I became really good friends, and I just think it's still a really interesting relationship, because most of our friendship, I mean, we got along sort of intuitively, but a lot of the friendship was about exchanging ideas and discovering that the reason why I understood that my father running a business, being a capitalist, had a positive intention. He was trying to do good in the world. He was trying to work hard for his employees and help everybody. Whereas Will had always thought that capitalists were just evil. And, you know, he had the other perspective. So that's the center of the story. It's a coming of age story. And then, of course, I'm very playful. So I'm very experimental. So I'm going to throw all sorts of other stuff in there. So if we have a reference to a philosopher, because this is the path of the character that's based on me, Alex will go off and study university, he'll study philosophy. So I was very interested in how were the ideas that we were discussing of their age. So, I mean, very much post-war ideas with the Shoah, the Second World War as a sort of moral boundary. And it occurred to me to wonder how much we take from formal philosophy gets into modern ideas. So I started researching what were the most prominent philosophers doing during the Second World War. So the answers, happily, are quite interesting. I won't tell you what I found out yet. But so along with this coming of age story, we also drop in and sit with Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Albert Camus, Hannah Arendt, and Walter Benjamin, and maybe a few others. Just to, we are flies on the wall of their lives for a few minutes to see what they were doing. And there's other bits. There are other stories in there as well, interwoven. So it's a little like Crow Court in there's many stories in there, but not one to the next. They're all interwoven. So, yeah, it'll be a little while yet, but that's what's coming. My pleasure, thank you.